Haunters, this is a bonus episode. This is Green Tagged, Theme Park in 30 from Scott Swenson and I. In this episode, we are summarizing some of the stumbling blocks that attractions still face to successfully reopening. Specifically, we discuss the new travel policies around the world, the new CDC guidelines, and how you can scale your workforce to prepare for this season. We are taking the rest of the week off because I have to move, and we'll be back on Tuesday with our regular show.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Green Tag Theme Park in 30. My name is Scott Swenson, and I am here with co-host Philip Hernandez from Gantam Lighting. Hi, Philip.
Hello.
And we're here once again for 30 minutes of everything we think is important in the attractions industry. So, we're starting to come out of a pandemic, it looks like, huh? You know, at least that's what we're all thinking. But we want to talk a little bit today about, we're not quite at that finish line yet. We're not quite to the point where we can all just kind of heave a sigh of relief. You know, lots of people are getting vaccinated. That's great. Places are starting to open again. That's great. But there are still some stumbling blocks. And I think the main challenge that we are finding now is a similar challenge that we've seen throughout the pandemic. And that is, every place is doing things a little bit differently. And no matter what regulations or recommendations are out there, it's kind of being left up to the frontline folks or the states or the provinces or the countries or whatever to sort of figure it out on their own. And before we get too deep into this, Philip has put together a really good list of kind of what's happening around the world and how different places around the world are adjusting to this situation. So, Philip, how are different countries dealing with this, and how does that compare to what's happening in the US?
Well, in New Zealand is allowing quarantine-free visits by Australians from April 19th, which is just next week. And they're basically trying to create a travel bubble for the neighboring nations, which have closed borders to the rest of the world to eradicate COVID. So they're making little travel bubbles. And in Britain, they're going to begin actually testing the vaccine passports that we discussed last time. And they're going to look at it for testing both internally, domestically, and looking for it to test internationally as that opens up. However, they're not even giving a date for their international travel yet. So residents are not allowed to travel abroad right now, as they are in not many other places. But they're anticipating that once they get this rolling, this passport will allow you to travel abroad once that they think that it's safe for you to do so. And once that opens, they have a traffic light system that they're going to try and implement, where they're going to code different countries as yellow, red, or green. And people arriving from green countries will have to be tested for the virus, but won't face quarantine. And meanwhile, in Japan, if you remember, we did talk about them implementing a state of emergency, which has since lifted, but the state of emergency failed to contain the new variant. And now Tokyo, Kyoto, and Okinawa are trying to push more measures, but the public is just not cooperating. The exact statement is that upturning cases has outpaced the government's expectation, with the public becoming desensitized to the impact of such warnings. In ending the emergency declaration, the central government essentially conceded that a further spike was inevitable and instead shifted its focus to minimizing other waves of cases. So basically they're like, well, state emergency is done, and we still have variants that are causing large outbreaks in these three areas. And the kind of the quasi, you know, the governors, for lack of, for their version of governors of those areas, are like, we need restrictions, we need to please close down. And they're kind of, it's this weird political move where the public is not happy about that, and they're trying to fight it. And meanwhile, the cases are ticking up, and there's state. And so, you know, that's fun. Meanwhile, in China, we talked about last time that they already had vaccine passports, in that they started off with a digital program from the beginning, from their vaccinations. Mm-hmm. But their vaccinations are not quite, the pace is not quite as robust as in the US. And so they're saying that they won't resume overseas travel until next spring. That's what their medical specialists are saying, is next spring. And it was a little funny because they're positioning that timeline as really good news, where I think here in the US, you know, we're saying everyone wants to be doing things by this spring, clearly. And in China, they're like, next spring. it's so early because we're doing so well. And we're like, oh, early. Okay. So bringing things back to the US here. Of course, I'm sure everyone has seen that we've seen coronavirus cases has increased again after hitting a low point. And some of the states driving the trend have also been hit hardest by the variants. And there's reporting on that all over. And to kind of coincide with this, Carnival Cruise Line and Disney Cruise Line are canceling sailings again. They're pushing back their sailings through the end of June. And Disney is announcing cancellations of all Disney Magic Cruises from European ports through September 18th, which we talked about last time, where they were going to try and use the European ports to launch cruises. So those are being pushed back as well. And finally, the CDC has a new guideline coming out saying that basically disinfecting of surfaces is pretty pointless. And that really this is a disease that you catch from the air, from breathing in particles that are in the air from other people. So basically they're saying unless there was somebody that you know was infected in a closed room, then it's really not going to help anyone to be disinfecting all these surfaces. And in fact, the statement from the White House briefing said, in most cases, fogging, fumigation, and wide area or electrostatic spraying is not recommended as a primary method of disinfection and has several safety risks to consider.
Well, there's just a bunch of minutiae there that I think we need to dissect a little bit and pull apart. I think the whole cleaning of surfaces thing, I think let's hold off on that for just a second, because that's
that's a big thing.
That's a whole issue in and of itself.
Yes, that's huge for attractions, yeah.
And I have a very, very strong opinion. What a shocker. I have a very strong opinion on that one as to why that is the case. But let's look at, you know, all these different places trying all these different things. We've said since the beginning of this pandemic that we are entering the wild, wild west because, again, we don't know for certain what's going to happen. We don't know for certain. We're getting more and more information. But anybody who thinks that the planet Earth is now an expert when it comes to the COVID-19 or any of the variants, you're wrong. I'm sorry. I very rarely say you're blatantly wrong. But if you think that we are now experts on this disease, you are wrong. We're still learning. We're still discovering what is going to work and what's not going to work. Unfortunately, from my perspective, not only are we having to deal with science, we're also having to deal with the interpretation of science or government. And that's why I think there's about a gazillion different rollouts. I mean, here just in the United States, you go state by state, county by county, and the way people get vaccines, the take of the local government or the state government differs from, you know, location to location. So I think that we still have that there, because there is no solid leader when it comes to what are facts in regards to this. We're used to scrambling because we were getting new information when this came out. You know, we've been dealing with this for over a year now. And when it first came out, the process was, okay, here's what we're going to, nope, that's not right. Okay, so here's the way we're going to, nope, wait, hold on, we found out this. And we're never going to get this, oh, wait, we can do that. Okay, we'll do that now. So that has become what we've become used to. We are able to sort of stumble our way through because that's what we've been doing for the last year. You know, anything you do more than 12 weeks becomes a habit. So now we have to undo those habits. We have to break the habits that the pandemic has required us to do and figure out how can we get behind good ideas and how can we embrace them to make certain that we're doing what we can to help control the virus. My opinion has been all along, and you've heard me say something similar to it, but I'm going to say it now in a very specific way. The solution to this problem is not in regulations. The solution to this problem, I don't even think, is necessarily in documentation. It's in taking personal responsibility. And, you know, again, this will be a nice segue into the cleaning process. The only thing that really that we know for sure helps reduce the spread is social distancing or physical distancing, personal hygiene, and taking personal responsibility. The reason, and you're thinking, well, then why doesn't everybody do this? And I think the reason for that is simple. It's because you can't mandate it. A government cannot require, cannot go up and arrest you because you're 3 feet, not 6 feet from somebody. It also, especially in the United States, it's a situation where people misinterpret that as loss of personal freedom. It's not. It's increase of personal responsibility. And, you know, this past Easter, I went out to dinner or to lunch, actually, in a restaurant that here in Florida did not require their staff to wear masks and did not socially distance indoors. And I have been so, I've become so accustomed to certain procedures that I was really uncomfortable, really, really uncomfortable. So much so that even like between, I won't even say courses, but like when I was taking a break from eating, I would actually put my mask back on. Now, I know for a fact that me wearing a mask protects me significantly less than it protects everybody around me. But still, I was uncomfortable, number one. And then I found myself getting stuck in the same trap. I wanted to make a statement. So I myself abandoned what I know to be science, that I'm not protecting myself by wearing a mask as much. And I've had my first vaccine. I haven't had my second yet. But so I abandoned science and wanted to make a statement. So I'm just as guilty as everybody else when it comes to how do we get out of this. I guess my point is, we are all, you know, it's a journey to recovery. It's not a light switch. We're not going to all of a sudden say, look, here's the exact right thing to do, and it's going to be perfect, and it's going to stop the disease dead in its tracks. Nope, not going to happen. Not going to happen. But I think we all need to take responsibility for ourselves and to act in a way that will reduce the spread based on the things that we know to be 100% true. And, you know, that goes in, this leads perfectly into our cleaning issue. And should we be surface cleaning and electrostatically cleaning and fumigating and all that? Okay, we thought that was going to be a good idea. But more importantly, for companies, it's something that they could say, look what we're doing. And it's much easier, you know, there have been article after article after article written about the biggest challenge is convincing people to wear masks. It's so hard. We would much rather spend money on something that will spray something down than to train your frontline people to require people to wear masks. Mm-hmm. And we've heard those horror stories. We've heard people who are getting spit on. We've heard of people who are, you know, because it's such a volatile issue. So instead, we're going to do something that has now been proven to really not help. But we can at least say we're doing something. I think that it's the same mentality that usually happens with HR issues in large corporations. They'll do something that really doesn't affect the outcome, but it's something that they can say, look what we're doing. So I just think we need to find a way to encourage personal responsibility. And from a corporate attraction standpoint, I'm not exactly certain what that is or how to do it. Obviously, I don't want frontline employees spit on. Obviously, I don't want to have, distance cops like a 1960s Catholic dance, you know, where the nuns have to come around and, you know, leave room for the Holy Spirit kind of thing. I don't want to do that. But the bottom line is, until such time as we take responsibility for ourselves and for sharing our concerns with others and create an environment where it's okay to say, you know what, I would prefer that you wear a mask while you're here without having somebody spit on you. That's what needs to change. And unfortunately, that's the hardest thing to change. It's deceptively simple because all people have to do is be nice and be, you know, smart. But you can't necessarily mandate nice or mandate smart. So I see it as a gigantic challenge, even though on the surface it seems ridiculously simple. Mm-hmm. That's my tirade. So
quite a tirade.
Sorry.
Well, I do think that the takeaway of this is, yes, cleaning theater, we have to examine if the cleaning theater is partially just for us to make ourselves feel, but I feel like we're doing the best that we can and realize that it is I guess I'm not sure whether guests are going to expect it, you know, because now we're going to get into the issue is everyone up to date on what the CDC is saying? Do they believe what the CDC is saying? You know, are customers now going to expect cleaning theater because they believe it does something? I'm not sure, but we know that it doesn't do anything against this. Now, it probably does do stuff against other stuff that can live on surfaces.
Yes.
You know, so it's not like it's completely useless, right? Like it does do stuff for other stuff that can transfer on surfaces, but for COVID, not as much. And to Scott's point, the real challenge for attractions is deciding what you are going to do first, as in what you are going to try, what stand you're going to try and take, like Scott's statement. Are you going to try and make the statement when everyone around you is not? And then looking at, I mean, I think one thing we didn't mention was the ventilation. Ventilation still does help.
Yes.
But it's just a whole different animal. You know, a lot of places do not have the funds to go in and replace all their HVAC systems. You know, but if you do have, I think that would be something to bring into the cleaning theater at this point. If you do have a state-of-the-art system that is, you know, is proven, like the airline systems, that should be something that you put out there in part of your new cleaning theater program, is that, you know, you have this ventilation system that works really well. You know, but to Scott's point, that's still not going to, you know, I think attractions can keep the distance with people. We saw that, again, I keep going back to my example of Universal of their, when their mazes were open. I was shocked at how well they were able to keep people, distanced, because they were able to have cast members in and put tape markers on the floor. And even if you were walking through this haunt experience, they were able to distance people. But
Philip, at the same time, we've experienced other examples from other locations that were not able to keep people distanced. They would put little signs up at the front just because they felt they needed to, but there was absolutely no follow-up. There was really no hard limiting of the number of guests that were in the park or at the attraction.
Yep. And it's hard to, so it is hard in those main areas, you know, in the walkways or in the areas where just people congregate, or an entry, you know, in passageways, through lines, you know, those places are really hard to, because it's a personal choice, as Scott said. And I think the attraction has to decide how much are you going to put into encouraging positive behavior if you want to make sure that people are remembering to stay distanced, because you're not going to be able to control every single square foot of your attraction. You can control a ride line because it's a line, but you can't really control the food court where people are standing around, or I don't know. That's probably can't control the food court, but.
And my suggestion, my personal suggestion, if it were, you know, if I were running a big theme park and it was called Scotland or Scotland, wait a minute, I probably couldn't do that. Anyway.
Scotland is doing pretty good, actually.
Scotland's doing quite well. Yes. Yes. But, you know, Swensenland, if I were going to invest money, I would not invest money in some of the surface cleaning procedures. I would invest money in training frontline employees.
Yes.
So that they have the tools that they need, the training that they need to continue to reinforce the only real thing that has been proven to reduce, and that is keeping people physically distanced, wearing masks so that the person, and not wearing masks to protect the wearer, but to protect those around the wearer. And then if I still had capital money left over, I'd, you know, look into HVAC and filters and that sort of thing. But, you know, at this point, based on what we know, and this could all change tomorrow, because let's face it, it's happened with this pandemic before, but based on what we know right now, the simplest action is the most difficult to reinforce and to enforce. So, but it's also the most effective.
And so, we know that we're not quite out of the woods yet.
Oh, not even close. Not even close. Now, it's funny, you did mention the cruise lines in there. And I know that they're doing this sort of, it's what they used to call and still call when you're traveling on a plane, it's a rolling delay. They're doing a rolling delay concept with the cruise lines. I've talked to a couple people who are in the cruise line industry, and they're saying the first cruises out of the U.S. probably will not go out until November. That's sort of the nothing official, but sort of the internal buzz. I also know that there are people who have, you know, who booked cruises the middle of last year and have just been sort of rolling over their money. And some lines are even offering, if you roll over your money, they'll give you, you know, 10, 15, 20% more towards your next cruise. So there are some people who are getting cruises for half price that have been doing this for, you know, a full year. But I will tell you, the cruise lines all would much rather actually be sailing, because, you know, cruises are not like your basic amusement park. You can't just shut them down, turn them off, and leave them be. You have to keep them running. You have to keep them staffed. You have to keep them maintained. Otherwise, they slowly disintegrate and the companies lose their key assets. So when they come back, they're screwed. So they want to be sailing. And it's interesting because, to add just another wrinkle, because I am Florida-based, Governor DeSantis here in Florida is actually suing the federal government to get cruise lines back quicker, sooner. And the question came up, I was having a discussion about this the other day, and the question came up, do the cruise lines really even want to get back a whole lot sooner? And I think they do, but I also think they recognize that they don't want the risk to their passengers or to their crew. So this legal fight over, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how valid it is. It seems silly to me, but it seems like posturing to me by our governor. But I am certainly not an expert, so I don't know how that's going to turn out. I mean, obviously we all want the same thing, and I'm not sure a lawsuit is going to get us there any quicker. My opinion.
Well, okay. Shall we to the next story then?
Sure. Now it's funny because here we are talking about, oh, everything's being delayed and blah, 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 blah. And yet people are coming back already in droves. I was just at a theme park, not last weekend, the weekend before, and it was packed. And I know they were still at quote unquote reduced capacity, but even that has, here in Florida, that isn't really a thing anymore. They can do whatever they want. And it was packed. And the biggest challenge was every place was understaffed. Mm-hmm. So queues were running, queues for roller coasters were running about 3 hours, 2.5 to 3 hours. Fast pass, the fast pass front of line access was running roughly an hour. And it was because their staffing was low. And so they couldn't run everything at its fullest capacity because they didn't have the people to make that happen. But there are some places and some companies around the world that are looking into this and trying to find a way to make it, to trying to find a way to help and make things better. What's going on with the Japanese Airlines thing? What's that all about?
This was really interesting, and I actually have not heard of this, but that's probably just because I'm American, and we tend to look at our local news first. I'm not sure how this would work in the U.S., but in Japan, the Japanese Airlines are basically loaning employees to other companies, so. I'm going to read some quotes here. Amid deteriorating earnings due to the virus crisis, the airlines are trying to reduce personnel costs by asking other companies and organizations that accept their employees to shoulder wages and other costs. The period of temporary transfers ranges from 1 day to 2 years. And this is a significant chunk. Japan Airlines alone has about 1,400 they're loaning out. So basically they're taking their staff and they're like loaning them to other companies, and they're still like technically employed by the airlines, but there's like reimbursements happening from other companies. And apparently there's also government incentives behind this. I didn't quite understand, but it's similar to our wage reimbursement for the family care leave that we had, where it's similar to that actually if you were loaning employees out but keeping them employed. So they are getting like partial reimbursements, and then other companies are paying for it. So they're trying to get to like 90% of the wage of the employee, even though they're loaned out. So very interesting, especially because the cabin, the stewardesses and the stewards are in the highest demand because of their skill set with talking to people and languages. So their customer service skills. So very interesting model.
What's going to happen when all of a sudden the cabin crew discovers, you know what? I can make a bunch more money doing this new career that I've been loaned out to. What's going to happen then?
I am not sure. I'm also not sure that that is as much of a concern in Japan. You know, the kind of like the company loyalty thing is a thing.
Oh, true. True.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that they would do that. It might even hurt their prospects of getting a different job. But it is interesting because the deals are set in place. So even though they could be extended, you know, if you set a deal for a 2-year position, it's not like you can, if the airline suddenly picks up whenever Japan decides they might want to start allowing travel again through its borders and the airline industry picks up, if someone's on a contract for 2 years, you're not gonna be able to yank them back immediately. So it will be an interesting scaling problem to see how that works out.
Yeah. The attraction, the theme park that I went to a couple of weeks ago, when I talked to some of their internal staff, they were saying, we just can't ramp up quickly enough. We can't get the staff back. And what's interesting is there is a company here in the U.S. that anybody who's been involved with theme park entertainment at least knows their name, and that's RWS, that is trying to come up with a solution for this. RWS Entertainment Group has announced the launch of RWS Staffing, a turnkey staffing solution for theme parks and resorts. This innovative service supports the live entertainment and full-scale productions RWS is known for, assisting clients in a very real need to fill seasonal operations and guest service positions. So it's not just on stage now. RWS is doing turnkey staffing to help support some of the more frontline team members with, I'm assuming, some of the staff that they have that are entertainers that have been out of work for a while. Because, you know, entertainment is usually the last thing to come back in most attractions, certainly sit-down shows or anything that will require people to gather closer than 6 feet. So I think this is interesting. It sounds to me, and I don't know this for a fact, but it sounds to me like this is RWS trying to provide sort of the same thing that the airlines are providing, and that is an opportunity for some of their people to work, not necessarily in their primary job or their entertainment gig, but if you are an entertainer, chances are good you have some of that same skill set you were talking about in the airlines, as far as the ability to talk to people face-to-face, good communicators, good representatives for companies and organizations, which I thought it was interesting that they said both operations and guest service positions. I think it's an interesting pivot. Now, I know, Philip, you have a feeling about this. How do you feel this is going to go?
Well, to clarify first on the types of positions, they will fill open guest relations, front desk, operations, food service, retail, entertainment roles with aspiring and seasoned entertainers looking for opportunities to expand their experience. And they do explain in the press release how they have had extensive training in health and safety and kind of the things that Scott and I talked about for the first 20 minutes of the show. Yep. So that kind of side of it. So, okay. So here's my take on it. Okay. It's probably gonna be a problem. So I do not ever disregard the value of this, so for me, there's always a delicate balance between our obsession in the US with outsourcing employee roles, and the counterbalance of that, which is the need to create your own robust culture. So do not build your house on rented land. It doesn't mean just that you only have Facebook as a website. It also means that you don't outsource key positions that will make it difficult for you to pivot when you need to. So use this for the things you truly need to use it for. You know, it's like outsourcing entertainers allows you to bring in expertise that you couldn't afford to have year round. That's always been the thing. You know, and venues are always hiring out people when they bring in concerts, when they bring in whatever. You know, that is great. But are you going to hire out your creative team? you might need to right now, but that is not a good long-term strategy.
Well, and I don't think this is even designed to be long-term strategy. RWS does not want
to disagree.
I don't think RWS wants to be in the staffing industry for the rest of their career.
But even if they don't want to, I think this sets up a dangerous precedent to get people thinking in terms of, well, we don't have to deal with any of this now. We can just, even if they change employees, you know, they have turnover already. So we can just keep replacing these people. And my caution is, like, do not just keep replacing your staff members and be okay with losing all of the ability to train them.
I think that what you're, the challenge we're going to run into here, and the reason I'm not necessarily in agreement with you in this particular case, Philip, is having worked in a major theme park, it is significantly more cost effective to hire and train and run your own staff than to pay someone else to do it. And mm-hmm. that's why I say, and I'm certain that the people that RWS is putting in here are not cheap. And I'm certain that they are not doing this out of the goodness of their heart, and they are taking a percentage off the top. So for places that already have a human resources department who are all set up to pay staff, they're going to use this as a stopgap or an opening. You know, I can see it in the future, maybe using it for parks that are just opening, parks that are seasonal, and they use a staffing service for the first month when they reopen until such time as they can build up their internals. But as you said, they are very specific about the positions that they are calling out. And you always want to have your core team in there, your senior leadership staff. You need them. You can't sub them out. But in a situation like this where they need to ramp up and they need to ramp up quickly, I think this is something that at least deserves some consideration. And if you can make it work within your budget, look at it. I've known Ryan for a long, long time, Ryan Stanna, and he's sharp. He is a smart guy. And he's obviously seen the need for this, and he sees it, I think, as a win-win, so that it gives his performers an opportunity to get some work, because they've been sitting on twiddling their thumbs for the last year. And it's also a way to continue to develop relationships with the theme parks and the clients that they normally work with. So that's my opinion.
Not disagreeing with any of that. The last thing I want to say is, if you are considering using a service like this, please check in to see how much the staff, the performers, or whoever that you're outsourcing to, how much they are actually getting paid. Mm-hmm. And be very careful that as to understand all of the particulars as to what you can and cannot do with them. Especially in California, those types of laws get very tricky. So understand that, but also make sure that you know that they are getting all their needs met. Because not to say that RWS is doing this, I have no idea. But there are a lot of companies out there that provide outsourcing solutions where they do not provide equitable pay to the staff members. And so make sure that you're aware of all of how everyone is being compensated if you're trying outsourcing. That's all I'm saying.
And that should actually be part of the agreement. They should be that transparent. So you know what you're paying for the service and what you're paying for what the individuals are being paid. All right. Well, we've already gone over. So it's time for us to say goodbye. On behalf of Philip Hernandez from Gantam Lighting, my name is Scott Swenson from Scott Swenson Creative Development. Again, thank you for listening. Tell everybody about the show and leave those great comments. And we'll see you next week for 30 more minutes of theme park and attractions news. Take care.
And that is it for today. From the Haunted Attraction Network, I'm Philip, and this was your Haunt News Briefing. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you catch our shows every Tuesday and Thursday. And if you like this episode, please leave us a review in iTunes and share this episode with a friend. Today's episode was sponsored in part by Gantam Lighting and Controls. It was produced by me, Philip Hernandez, with post-production and editing by David Swope, and music provided by Chris Thomas. And if you want to be part of the conversation, join our Facebook group at Haunters Toolbox. If you have news or a story to report, drop me a line at philip@hauntedattractionnetwork.com. And until next time, everyone, stay scary.
This is a Haunted Attraction Network production.